skeptic that I think around that time, no, it was standing on a tripod. Both horizontally. So we trees in the back. I remember, what am I trying, I'm trying to recall it, but I walked, I was standing behind the antenna and you walked around and said hello to everybody, over.
Yeah, your push to talk button is jumping out a couple of times, but interesting. Yeah, it used to take me, about 45 minutes or so to assemble that antenna. It all came in kit form for transport. A 12-foot diameter dish that folds up into the trunk of a car. And I think that was Saddlebrook Park, which is a much longer ride for me because in those days I was living in Smithtown, Long Island, Summit County. You only had to travel from Brooklyn. You had to, a little more than half the distance to get to Saddlebrook Park, New Jersey. And those contests were run by Paul Wade, WA2ZZF, I think his call letters were in those days, and Alan, K2UIH. A lot of water under the bridge since then. And I think that was after the time that I had used that for Apollo 15 and 16 reception, which took place in 1971. So I got a lot of mileage out of that antenna. And I think you probably know I eventually sold it to some Stony Brook students who are doing some kind of a radio astronomy experiment. And I'm dreaming about building a slightly larger antenna like that to be used on 10 gigahertz, a 10 by 15 foot fly swatter antenna. But that's another long-range plan, it says here. I think we've covered everyone who signed in. If Joe is still there, now that the Eastern... I just checked. The Eastern machine is working. Joe, you want to give it a try if we haven't put you to sleep? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
K-2-Y-O.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Please put me in the question queue, but Joe's got the higher priority. But if you do have time for questions, put me in the queue, please.
Okay, if Joe doesn't come back, you're in the queue right now.
And who's in?
Looks like Joe's not there. We may have put him to sleep. You got a comment, Wesley? Go ahead.
I just want to say that I've got a book. I made it. The book is probably 8 inches thick, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, I kind of thought Eugene had an interesting piece of history there. Bernie, why don't you fire ahead with your question? Right now, you're number one on the runway.
Dick, a while ago, well over a year ago, you and Mel were talking about an antenna. It was an HF vertical antenna, and it was designed to be elevated. And fortunately, thanks to you, Dick, I have at least somewhat understanding of how a quarter-wave antenna radiates now and how that works. But this specific vertical HF antenna had what they called an elevated feed point. And you had made some comments about how that changed some of how the antenna behaves and its need for a ground plane. Could you elaborate more on that, about what does an elevated feed point do for you on an HF vertical?
There's lots and lots of ways of doing this. If it was a simple quarter-wave radiator, vertical ground plane antenna, you have to lay down a whole lot of ground plane radials. What you're trying to do is make with the equivalent of a sheet of metal by a whole lot of ground plane radials, you're trying to create the mirror image of the other half of the antenna. Turns out that essentially every single antenna we ever use really is a dipole. It may be a non-symmetric dipole. I mean, there's nothing magic about making the left-hand side and the right-hand side of a horizontal dipole. You don't have to make them exactly in the same diameter. You don't have to be made out of the same materials. And you don't have to feed it in the center. You can feed it anywhere from the left end toward the center toward the right end. As long as you're using the right kind of balancing device, you can feed that dipole anywhere you want. When you take that horizontal dipole, let me drop, and you set it up vertical, and first of all, while that dipole was horizontal, I can put a sheet of metal at right angles to the wire of the dipole right down the center. Because the E-field is horizontal and the sheet of metal is essentially vertical, the antenna does not see the sheet of metal. Nothing happens. Nothing changes. But once the sheet of metal is there, an infinite sheet of metal, right at the center, at the feed point of the ordinary dipole, I can decide to feed the right-hand side of the dipole, throw away the left-hand side, and the other half of the dipole is the mirror image in that infinite sheet of metal. And now I take that sheet of metal, bring it down to the ground, and if it's an infinite sheet of metal on the ground with a quarter wave radiator above it, perpendicular to it, I've got a beautiful ground plane antenna. Of course, none of us wants to put an infinite sheet of metal there. So now we make up that infinite sheet of metal in a skeleton manner with ground plane radials. Depending on how many ground plane radials you lay down, some of the RF energy looks between the wires of the ground plane radio and starts lighting up the dirt. And the dirt is a volumetric lossy material. You may get a beautiful standing wave ratio, but it's not very difficult to have 50% of the RF energy you want to radiate heating up the dirt in your backyard. The worms are happy in the wintertime, but you've lost some of the power you could have been radiating. Now, as that ground plane radials, you've got a couple of choices here. One, you can make an infinite number of ground plane radials. That's one way of stopping the RF energy from going between them. A little bit of it will still crawl around the tips of it, but not very much. But that takes a lot of resources. Let me drop. Another approach is to make the vertical portion of the antenna not a quarter wave long, but a half wave long. Now the high current point is a quarter wave above your ground plane radial system, and you're feeding an extremely high impedance point, roughly 1,500 ohms, and a hell of a lot less ground plane radials are required. You've got a higher phase center. The high current portion of the antenna is now further above the ground. It doesn't have anywhere near as much characteristic to light up the dirt. That's one approach. 5/8 wave, half wave, radiator, all of these things help. Making the ground plane radials higher above the ground also is another good way of, by putting some distance between your antenna and the earth, you don't light up as much of the dirt. In the case of something like a station master antenna, a 2-meter ground plane antenna used often at repeater sites, let me drop, because that antenna is typically mounted multiple wavelengths above the ground, three simple little ground plane radials do the job very nicely. There is no nearby dirt to light up, so they can have extremely high efficiency because you're some number of wavelengths above ground. So elevating the ground plane radial system and or extending the length of the radiator all helps a whole lot. Half wave is the ideal as far as efficiency is concerned, because now there's very little current going into that ground plane radial system. And in the case of a half wave radiator fed at the bottom, a vertical radiator, a simple stake into the ground for the ground plane radial system probably would give you something close to 90% efficiency. No real radials required at all. A number of guys, in fact, have done the elevated half wave electronic radiator by way of a helical wound radiator, and the counterpoise in that case has been in some cases used as the railing on a balcony of an apartment building, and that works very well. So what you're trying to avoid here is lighting up the dirt, and you also would like to have as high a feed point as possible. So whatever you do to raise the high current point of the antenna, like going to a halfway radiator, all of those things help. We can now go into what really goes on inside the antenna, but maybe that's part of what you're looking for, Bernie. K2IO, K2IO comes on the deck.
Well, that's a good place to start, and we may just want to leave it this so I can think about this a while. It is the point that the air makes a better capacitive coupling than between the radiators than the dirt does?
you'd like to not feed any RF energy into the dirt, because if RF energy literally gets to the dirt, it's a volumetric resistive material that sucks up RF energy, turns it into heat, and it's got such a great big volume, even with an accurate thermometer, you may not see the heat, but it could be taking a substantial percentage of your RF energy. Any RF energy you turn into heat, it's gone forever. You never get a chance to use it. That's the only real way of losing RF energy, is to turn it into heat. Other than that, it goes somewhere in the universe that's going to give somebody some benefit. What's really going on with the antenna itself is that electronically every antenna is a half-wave radiator or more. You think you've got your rubber duck antenna as a quarter-wave radiator coming out of the top of your handy-talkie. The metal package that's in your hand, the rest of the radio, is the other half of that non-symmetric dipole. There's nothing magic about making the dipole symmetric. Nothing magic about feeding it in the center. But essentially every antenna is a half-wave dipole. You may think it's a quarter-wave antenna. The counterpoise system by way of the mirror image, or the other half of the dipole in the case of the metal package of a rubber duck and a handy-talkie, the other half of the dipole is there. In the case of the handy-talkie in your hand, a certain percentage of the RF energy is absorbed by your hand, and it's warming up your hand. So if I did a real scientific study of a handy-talkie in the hand of a 2-meter handy-talkie, I probably could confirm that when I'm transmitting, I'm going to pick a number, 15 or so, maybe 20% of the RF energy is absorbed as heat in my hand, because the counterpoise is RF hot and I'm holding on to it. By the same token, whenever you do a serious study of a cell phone, let me drop. Every cell phone radio, in order to be qualified for that particular service, passes three individual tests, or a bank of tests. One of them is called TRP, total radiated power, in free space. You take the cell phone in question, mount it in the right kind of a test environment where you're essentially measuring its free space characteristics, and you measure total radiated power. That's got to be above some particular number. In other words, you literally measure the pattern across the whole sphere of space, left, right, up, down, every single point in space where it's radiating power. You collect all of that power and figure out what is the total radiated power. It's got to be above a certain number in order for you to qualify. That's test number one. Test number two is total integrated sensitivity. Total integrated sensitivity is that you again measure the receiver sensitivity when you squirt signals at it from every possible angle across the whole sphere. That's the free space requirement. Then the next requirement is, what is the TRP and TIS when you have a hand holding it and a head nearby, and they have a sham or a phantom head and a sham or a phantom hand holding it, and you do another test. And in that particular test, you then start evaluating what is the specific absorption rate that the worst case, hottest point of the human being will experience when that cell phone is running at maximum power. And you want that specific absorption rate to be below 1.6 watts per kilogram. That's a radio frequency biohazard specification. Let me drop. So as you can see here, is that whenever you take something with a lot of water content, a human being's got a lot of water content. The ground has a moderate amount of water content. Whenever you take a water-bearing substance, put it in the reactive near field of an antenna, and then you evaluate how much of the RF energy gets coupled into that water-bearing substance, you can evaluate how much of the RF energy gets wasted by being turned into heat, and when it comes to efficiency of an antenna, that counts. The higher you can mount your HF antenna, the more benefit you're going to get. You're bringing it away from the Earth. And if you've got to have it near the Earth, then you want to cover that Earth with as much metal as possible so that the antenna cannot couple that RF energy into the Earth and waste it on you. And there's also other characteristics you care about. What is the vertical angle of radiation? And which portion of the skip zone are you looking for that particular DX contact? But as you can see, when it comes to efficiency of radiation and local nearby Earth and or human being, RF energy has a whole lot of other characteristics you might care about. K2IO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Welcome to the W2.
Okay, Dick, I thank you very much. I'm going to have to think about this for a little bit, and I think I understand the trade-off in the HF world where you're looking at if you raise the feed point, you're theoretically going to have to shorten the antenna because you can't just keep putting an infinite amount of wire up into the air, and that becomes a trade-off of whether you run your radiator from the ground up or raise the feed point and possibly lose some height on your antenna. So, interesting point. I thank you very much. K2IO will be clear.
Run that one by again, Bernie. I can start off with an ordinary ground plane radial with the ground plane radials on the ground, and it's a quarter wave radiator. I can start extending the length of that radiator up to 5/8 wave. We know what that is, but I could go all the way to 5/8 wave. Is that beyond half? Yes, beyond half. The magic of a half wave or 5/8 wave radiator is that you're now feeding one end of the antenna. You'd have to do some impedance matching, but the higher the phase center of the antenna, the high current point is at the center of a dipole, and if you're feeding the bottom of the half-wave dipole, because the impedance at that point is 1,500 ohms as opposed to 35 ohms, roughly a 35 ohms is what you've got at the bottom of a quarter-wave ground plane. As you make that quarter wave ground plane radiator go to half wave long, the feed impedance climbs up to roughly 1,500 ohms. You're now launching so little current into that open circuit end of the antenna, the high current point is now a quarter wave above the ground. All of a sudden now, you could say the high current point making the strong magnetic field in the center of a half wave dipole, if that's near the dirt, and the dirt is not shielded with a whole lot of conducting material, then it's going to couple that RF energy into the dirt. The high impedance point at the bottom end of a half-wave radiator has very little current capability that it can launch into that nearby dirt, and all of a sudden your efficiency climbs up nice and high, and your angle of radiation gets lower, your phase center is now a quarter wave above the ground. That's a much more desirable situation. If you want to start going beyond half wavelength and length, 5/8 wave is one of the points that very many people think gives you maximum energy on the horizon. You could, if you want to, go beyond 5/8 wave. There's nothing stopping you from making the vertical radiator any number of wavelengths you want if you have the resources to do that. When you start making it more than a half wave long, and if you don't start putting in the right kind of choking assemblies at the right point, you start developing a very complicated vertical multi-lobe antenna, and if some of those lobes don't fall in the right spot, you might not be happy. You're not going to do this on 80 meters, but on 10 meters, you could, if you want to, make an antenna that's a 1.5 wavelength of radiator above a ground plane. But there's curves in the antenna book that will tell you what the vertical radiation pattern will look like if you do that. You're going to have a bunch of lobes with a bunch of nulls in between those lobes, and if one of those nulls falls on the angle that you want to go to the horizon in order to talk to your buddy in London, it might not make you happy. Maybe this is some of what you're asking, Bernie. K2IO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I think I know what he's alluding to, Dick.
Let me first find out what Ernie is, Bernie is saying, then I'll go over to Mel next. Bernie first, go ahead.
What I was referring to is if we're talking about 40 or 80 meters, on 80 meters, a half wave is 40 meters. I'm not going to be able to run a vertical radiator 40 meters up and straight up into the air, let alone elevate it another half wave up and now 80 meters up for the top of this thing. So the antennas, and these are all commercially manufactured antennas, I've seen this in relation to, we're talking about everything's a trade-off because we can't put a half wave vertically up. So So you're talking about one trade-off versus a different trade-off, and which one, shall we say, gives you the least degradation in performance. Does that make sense?
In a way it does, but there's one more trick you've got in your bag of tricks, Bernie. When you make that half-wave vertical radiator, half-wave long on 40 meters, it doesn't have to be physically half-wave. Only has to be electronically half-wave to get many of these benefits. By spiral winding it, by putting loading coils in it, by putting top hat and bottom hat loading capacitors, there's various ways you can mechanically shrink that half-wave radiator and make it electronically a half-wave, but maybe physically it's only a quarter-wave. And that's perfectly legal. And there's a lot of benefit of doing that. So consider that as a possibility. K2KEY, K2RIW. You got us, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. You know, they market a number of vertical antennas with so-called elevated feed. We sort of went into this in a lot of detail some months ago. And I did some experiments one time. I got fascinated by one particular antenna, which was putting out some very good claims as to the number one selling vertical and the number one vertical on the market for a lot of reasons, small footprint and everything, and covers 80 through 6 meters. And a number of things, I did get to make some measurements on the antenna. My friend owns one down the block. So I was able to peruse, as they say, over the antenna, and I discovered some very interesting facts about the antenna. What happens with elevated feed stick and this so-called strange counterpoise that they use. I think that's what he may be interested in, because, for instance, for on 80 meters, the total height of the antenna is around 30 smart feet, just over.
But the word elevated feed has got some vocabulary ambiguity to it. Let me go back to that simple half-wave horizontal dipole, essentially in free space. The majority of the energy you put into that dipole bounces back and forth at least 10 and probably 20 times before it gets radiated into space. That's why you make it electronically resonant, so that all of those bounces stay in step. They stay co-phase. The energy is going to bounce back and forth. You're ringing a bell continuously when you put high-power RF energy into that half-wave dipole. And there's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. You can feed it in the center, 10% off of the center, 50% off the center, all the way out to the outer end. As long as you've got the right impedance matching network, the right kind of a balancing network, you can feed it anywhere you want, and you will, in that example I'm giving, get 100% essentially radiation efficiency. Use the right materials, feed it anywhere you want with the right balance and impedance match, and of the 100 watts you put into that antenna, 99 of those watts will be radiated into space. So where you feed it doesn't matter. If I take that horizontal half-wave dipole and I decide to use it in a vertical manner, where I feed it doesn't matter. People call it elevated feed. If I make it a half-wave long radiator and I feed it at the very bottom of a vertical half-wave electronic radiator, let me drop, I really have an elevated feed. The high current point of that half-wave dipole was in its center. If I plotted current versus position of that half-wave horizontal dipole, there's minimum current at the ends, there's maximum current in the center. If I plotted that across that dipole, it would look like a Quonset hut. Highest current is in the center. That's where the graph would have the highest position off of the baseline, so to speak, and it hits zero at the left-hand end and the right-hand end. The phase center of that dipole is the high current point. When I now take that horizontal dipole and I mount it vertical, if it's a half-wave radiator, you pick up an advantage. If I elevate the whole thing and it's ground plane radials above the ground, you pick up multiple kinds of advantage. Where I feed it doesn't matter. I could feed it at the very bottom of a half-wave radiator. Technically, that is an elevated feed point, elevated fed antenna, because the phase center, the high current point of that half-wave vertically polarized radar, the high current point would be quarter wave above the ground, even though I'm feeding it at the bottom. It would have all the performance of a elevated feed antenna. Whether I do some kind of exotic feeding network where I really feed it in the exact center of that half-wave vertical radiating element, or if I feed it at the bottom, performance-wise, there is no difference. I wonder if that makes some sense, Bernie. So there's a little bit of ambiguity of terms here of elevated feed point. K2YO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, but Bernie first. Go ahead, Bernie.
Yes, this definitely does make sense. And yes, Mel, you're exactly on subject. It's related to the conversation. You had gotten some input, I believe it was about 18 months ago now. I'm going to be seeing the guys that manufacture these things later on in the week in Dayton. And I just wanted to be able to be a little bit more intelligent in understanding what they're saying and what they're claiming. I have spoken to them before about the incident that happened about 18 months ago, which they said they were completely non-involved. None of their people had contacted Mel. And they basically said their antennas are some of the best verticals. They will not say that they'll outperform a dipole because there are too many trade-offs to have them do that. So thank you very much, Dick. This is making a lot of sense.
Yeah, when it comes to the ideal way of feeding an ideal HF antenna in your backyard, it is far from a simple subject. Lots of ways of doing it, lots of ways of understanding it, lots of opinions have been developed over the years. I'm coming from a VHF point of view where I do daily testing of antennas, and so I personally haven't had a whole lot of HF experience. So there is the possibility, without a doubt, as I've said so many times, there's some errors in some of the things I've told you. I'm telling you where my theory is coming from, what my theory is, why I feel that way. And then if you guys find out that, hey, Dick, you didn't consider the so-and-so phenomena, there may be more to the story. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW, what are you doing up so late?
I was lying down, Dick, and actually ready to pull the plug. It's old, and I heard the conversation about the elevated feed point vertical antennas, and the first one that kind of popped into my mind was the Titan. There's an antenna where they basically feed the feed line up the center, and really, I guess when you analyze that one versus a lot of the other available verticals, I guess one of the reasons that they do it, from what I've seen of the antenna, is that they like to do multi-band. And I guess the position of where they were able to mechanically locate the other elements to radiate for multiple bands, the feed point just worked out to be a little bit nicer mechanically, to be in an elevated point. So this way, when you run the coax up and you attach it to all the multiple elements to radiate at, to be resonant at a whole group of HF frequencies, it worked out a little bit better that way. So I think that's also something Bernie might want to consider too, is that on some of these shortened verticals, like the Titan, yes, they do have a vertical feed point, but it's mainly not so much for performance, but to get a good mechanical design with multiple bands. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Don, good point, Glenn. As you can tell, I was thinking one band at a time. And I keep forgetting about the fact that you guys on HF, you want 5 or 7 bands to be fully operational. So when I design a VHF/UHF antenna, most of the time I design one band of frequencies at a time. Like a 915 megacycle license-free band, it'd like that antenna to work from 902 to 928 megs, 26 megs of bandwidth, but it's one single band, less than 3% bandwidth, which is considerably percentage-wise more narrow than the 80-meter ham band, which I think is 3.5% or something like that. So, good point. So, the real feed point, you might physically elevate it because at some one of those other frequencies, you're going to want to feed it at that point in order to make it all come out right. So you were saying, Mel, that you've done some experiments on elevated feed points. You might want to give us a paragraph on that subject. What did you discover? K2KEY. What do the guys on Dover Street do to get a lot of RF out of their backyard? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Glenn just said he's very right. When you need something that is mechanically very well constructed and has a small footprint, you know, you're in a situation where, well, I want to get on the air. I got to have something. And I can't go horizontally. I haven't got the room, you know, and small plots. Well, I can go up. Guess the sky goes way up there, but, you know, all kidding aside, you know, you want something that is not going to start to hurt the XYL or cause neighbors to make comments, stop pointing, what's that? So, you go ahead and you look at one of these things that, like he said, the Titan, and you see a pipe that is reasonably not that tall, you know, about 30 feet or whatever it is, and it covers 80 meters, 40 down to 10 meters, and it works. And the problem was, I looked at it, an interesting antenna. Let me make some measurements. What do you care, my friend, to do whatever you like. So it's sitting out on his patio deck, and the thing is mounted right there. Let me let it drop. They give you a connector coming out of the pipe with a short piece of wire, a piece of yellow wire, coax. I never saw coax yellow, but okay, they got yellow coax coming out of the pipe, and they got a connector there, and that's where you connect the coax to go in the house. So it was very nice and convenient. We're sitting there at the picnic table, and I said, let me do some measurements. Let me see what's going on here. And I was quite taken back, let's say. The resistance, like on 80 meters, was around, I think, around 4.5 ohms. And I think it was a capacitive reactance, minus J, like 450 ohms. And if you get to 10 meters, you get to a resistance around 22 ohms with a reactance of about minus J, I think it was around 40. And how did they get this thing to work? Well, they got a sort of a modified L network involved in here, and with transition rods, I mean, there's a lot of hocus-pocus going on, Dick. There's a lot more to it until you look at it carefully, over.
You usually can take the resistive component and divide it into the reactive component, and that tells you the minimum Q that you're going to get on the antenna. So when you got a great big reactive component, like 450 ohms, and a minimum resistive component of 4 ohms, that means the basic antenna, if those numbers were real, would have a Q of about 100. That means it's a 1% wide antenna at the 3 dB fall-off points, where the standing wave ratio is 5.6 to 1. That's a rather narrow band antenna. To impedance match what you just told me, 4 ohms resistive and 450 ohms reactance, relatively easy. Use the right materials and impedance matching, that is easy. However, the impedance matching network is not going to expand the bandwidth, with rare exception. There's something called, let me drop, the Bode-Fano criteria, where you, if you know the basic Q of your load, in this case it's that antenna, and you put an impedance matching network in there, what's the best broadbanding you're going to get? This Bode-Fano equation, which, I can't think of the name of the book now. It's a famous microwave book that's being used as a textbook. I've loaned it to my son, so I can't even go look at it. Anyhow, it tells you, if you look up Bode-Fano, you'll find out about it. It tells you what the maximum Q is. So my guess is, if that was the impedance it measured on 80 meters, I think you're telling me you're going to have to tune the antenna for the end of the 80-meter band you care about the most. I will admit that your antenna tuner, if it's got a wide enough tuning range, can accommodate this. But without the antenna tuner, I'll bet you that antenna is not more than 150 kc wide in the 80 meter band. Is that approximately what you saw, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
150 kilohertz on 80? No way. I think it was about 20 kilohertz, Dick, either side. That's it, before it took off, went someplace, who knows where. It was very, very narrow on. That's what it is. You got to set those that thing up. You've got the person to decide, are you going to use this antenna on phone or DW? That's the adjustment. That's the first. No, in fact, I think you have to order it. Yep, you have to order it and specify phone or CW of operation. You can't intermix this thing. This is the way it is. If you get a CW, it's only be for the CW band. It's not going to put, say, oh, I'll take 80 CW and 40 phone and something like that. It don't work that way. So it's a contraption, to say the least, when it gets you on the air. Over.
Yeah, I was rounding things off, and I was overly conservative, the opposite of conservative. From the numbers you gave me, 4 ohms resistor, 450 ohms reactance, and if you properly impedance match that, a rough calculation is it's going to be 30 or so kilohertz wide. You guessed 20, I'm guessing 30. At the 3 dB roll-off point, where it's 5.6 to 1 standing wave ratio, without an antenna tuner, essentially no modern rig is going to do that. That's 3 dB points. If you only can go to the 2 to 1 standing wave ratio points, now I'm beginning to believe not even a 20 kilohertz is going to do that. You can't go above, let's say, 1.8 to 1 on a modern-day no-tune rig. So even 20 kilohertz is a little bit wide. So without an antenna tuner, that is a fairly narrow-band antenna. And I think you're telling me that even with an antenna tuner, you have to decide, do you want it to be a CW antenna or a sideband antenna? And it may be beyond the range of tunability with a conventional antenna tuner. Is that approximately true, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Oh, well, this is what happened. It worked. It worked pretty good on 10, 15, 20 meters. Get up to 40, the thing starts to go a little bit nuts, to say the least. At 40 meters, I think that I think I got a resistance reading somewhere around about, I think, an 8. Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think I got 8 on 40 at about minus J275, I don't know, somewhere around that. So, what can I tell you? What I did, I said to him, I laid out basically looking at this thing, I said, you know, what you need is an L network for this. So, I figured out if, you know, with a simple L network, I could most likely get this thing to tune a lot better. So that's what I did. Made up a simple L network. We made up a simple thing on a piece of wood, an inductance, a couple of inductors, and a capacitor, a tuning capacitor, and all. And it took care of the problem. At least made it a usable antenna. You can move around the band a little bit, Dick, over.
Sounds like fun. But it's the basic laws of physics. The antenna's got to resonate in order to radiate. And if you haven't invested in the real estate, if physically the antenna is small compared to a half wavelength, the Q's got to go up. It's got to become more narrow. There's a set of equations written way back in 1947 by Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler. Harold Wheeler, and I can't think of Mr. Chu's name, and it's called the Chu-Wheeler criteria. Once you know the physical, what he calls radiant space, but once you know the physical size of the antenna in wavelengths, there's a minimum Q that antenna is going to have with those dimensions. And there is essentially no way beyond the laws of physics of exceeding that. So You can shrink an antenna as much as you want. The so-called infinitesimal dipole section of the JASIC and Krauss antenna book will let you do that. And you can get full performance out of a dipole at that one frequency, but you pay the price. We've only got about 2 minutes left, Mel. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1296 of the series that began in September of 1982. Mel and Vic hope to be back next week. Hope to answer some more of these questions, get more into the ham radio subject. We're thinking of taking it up as a hobby. That's a joke. Be kind to each other. And this is Forensic Engineering. We do discuss the pros and cons and the goods and the bads of troubleshooting procedures and whatever. That is what the TechNet does, and that does it best compared to most of the other nets that I know about. That's a philosophy. We think it works. At least it seems to have worked for 27 and a half years. Bye-bye, you all. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. Say goodnight to all. Yeah. Like I say, you had to tune out reactance. The average reactance was in there was over, like, plus, what the heck, you had a counteractor with an inductance of, like, plus 300 and plus ohms of inductive reactance to put into it. And that sort of helped out. So anyhow, it works. Again, that's the bottom line. Look at, don't look at it like they say, you know, as they say, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. And it's a situation. If it gets you on the air, that's the bottom line in a difficult situation. 73 is all. We'll try to do it again next week. Take care, everybody. This is K2KEY saying goodnight.
And one last word. A properly designed L network using the right material, at least at one frequency at a time, can match essentially any impedance in the world. If that antenna was 1 ohm resistance and 1,000 ohms of reactance, guarantee that you, Mel, could come up with an L network that at least at one frequency would make that thing work like a charm. So at least at one frequency at a time, don't let a crazy impedance scare you. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW.
They are in the handbook as the way to make up the coils and everything. You give them a nice neat formula for that. They're 100% right. With that L network, get anything to work. We'll get a clothes hanger to work on 80 meters. Good night, Vic.
Good night, Mel. Was there another person who said something? Go right ahead.
W2WKZ.
Go ahead, Eugene.
That guy, this is E-7-A.
Okay, I'm hearing you, Eugene. If you want to say something, go right ahead.
Okay, he has it, and his eyes were up when he's seen the book. It
sounds to me like you made a happy camper tonight, Eugene. Sounds to me like you gave that great big tome, this heavy book. I think you just said it was 8 inches thick. Sounds like you gave it to somebody who really appreciated it. I think he's going to keep it warm, and he'll feed it nothing but cookies and milk. Over to you, Eugene.
WB2HWW, please.
Go ahead now, take it, that's WCWK. Go ahead, take it.
Nick, I got a question for you real quick. An L network, is that just a coil and capacitor? I don't remember what it looks like. An L network, just a coil and a capacitor?
That's exactly right. It consists of a series inductor and a shunt capacitor, or a series capacitor or a shunt inductor. Both work equally well. And depending on whether you use the left-hand side as the input or the left-hand side of the output, is strictly a function of whether you're stepping up in impedance or stepping down. The junction of the L and the C is the high impedance point. The other end is the low impedance point. So it's one reactor positive, one reactor negative in an L configuration, one frequency at a time that will match anything, literally anything. Over to you, Howie.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
RBB2HWW.
KC2SYI. W, this is KC2HZE. If you're still there, just want to say thank you very much for another wonderful net. I had about 11 to 14 stations throughout the whole time, and they all enjoyed it. 73s, and we'll be back next week.
Very good, Mr. HZE. I think that's Eric, and if I've got it right. That's two weeks in a row, and no guarantees. Some of these nets get into boring subjects, and some of them we get into exciting stuff. Glad they appreciated it. What's your guess as to how many people were connected tonight, Eric? Go ahead.
All right, Dick. Yeah, the name is Tom, Tango, Oscar, Mike, Tom, and the call's KB2HZE. All right, throughout the whole night, I had 11 to 14. And like I said, I was bringing it in via RF earlier. I actually had to bring it in via RF. So it was very interesting. All right, but thank you very much. I'm going to say 73's best wishes. And we'll be back next week, and I'm bringing it in all the time. And K2YO was actually connected in through me because I had my remote base bringing RF back into my room. But I'll explain how that all works. And check out my website, kb2hz.com, 73s.
Very fine, Tom. I looked back at my notes last week, and I first had your name as Eric, and then below that I had Tom, and I looked at the wrong place tonight. Sorry about that. Okay, see you guys next week. Bye-bye, you all.
This is KC2SYL. Just want to express my gratitude to both Mel and Dick for conducting that. It's always a learning experience, and I really enjoy it. This is KC2SYL. Thank you, Bill.
Very fine, Bill. Good luck with those helical antennas. They're kind of fun. I think you're going to want to experiment with both helical antennas as well as single boom cross polarized Yagi. Each has its advantages and disadvantages. The good news is the materials are not expensive, and you may want to build both and fiddle with both of them. Good luck with that project, and let us know how it goes.
Okay, thanks. Good night.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Yagi that are cross-polarized because you can change the circular polarization. It's either left or right by how you hook them up.
You got even a little bit more adaptability than that, Eric. You can make pure horizontal, pure vertical, slant 45 right, slant 45 left, clockwise, counterclockwise, elliptical clockwise, elliptical counterclockwise. Is that enough for adaptability?
Yeah, I think so. No, actually, right now I'm right-hand circular polarized on the antenna that I'm using at the moment. And if I flip the switch, then it'll be left-hand circular polarized. Or if I flip the switch again, I could have it horizontal, or I could have it vertical.
And if you had a couple more switch positions, you could even make slant 45 right, which is what I'm transmitting to you right now. Let me think. No, I'm transmitting, slant 45 right is what I'm transmitting to you right now. Polarization is something else. Boy, are we polarized. Bye-bye for now, Eric. And thank you for reestablishing the EPG.
Yeah, they actually had some problems with it. Is it there consistently now?
The EPG itself, in other words, where they list what program name and what hours, yes. When it comes to the subheading, what's going on inside of that program, 80% of the time that's there. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, a lot of the stuff doesn't have descriptions, so, you know, if they don't get the description, it's just blank inside, so, you know, it's not an electronic function. It is a software function which is created by people, and some things like, you know, some shows it just says nothing, and then some shows it says the host's name, and some shows it gives a full description.
Did I hear you say last week that Alan Alda is thinking of making more of that series, Scientific American Frontiers?
No. what I was talking about was Nova Science Now, but I found out that I was wrong. It's out of production.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and you know who I meant, from Hayden Planetarium, Rose Center, will he be making any more programs?
Last summer seems to have been the last season of it, so there's nothing, even if you go to the website, there is no more at this point. You know, even GBH has its funding problems at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're saying quite a few of them come from GBH Boston. Do any of the other PBS centers make programming like that? I guess the closest we get is the helicopter scenes that are done by Channel 21. Is that true?
If you're talking about Division series, that's pretty much done at this point. All the people that used to make them are gone.
If I wanted to be a little bit pessimistic, you're telling me I don't have a great deal to look forward to?
Let's see now. Bill Moy is retired for the third time. We've got a new show called Need to Know. I don't know if you've seen it or not. I think they didn't find any more new funding for now, which is a good show. We used to have a show called World Focus, but I call it different words that I can't use on the air. And that's gone. Although Mr. Tish actually did something good for the station. He finally, he's the chairman of the board. None of the board members have donated money, but he decided he was going to donate $15 million, which kind of like fills some of the debt hole, but doesn't cover a heck of a lot. We play the BBC now that we actually have to pay for that we used to make money on. Stuff like that.
I'm a little bit amazed that BBC was a moneymaker and it got dropped. And now that you're going back to it, it's not quite as much of a moneymaker. It does sound like something got lost in the process there.
Well, to make a long story short, fiscal mismanagement is one aspect of it. The new president, who used to be the president of NBC News, since he was the vice president of NBC News, you can figure that his focus in the world is very corporate-oriented and very news-oriented. And when he came in, the BBC was about to start branding themselves a little more on air. Meaning, for more information, go to bbc.com.uk, they would announce that go to the BBC website. And since the news guy decided he didn't want that, that we would, send them on their way. And by the way, the Los Angeles station for years has been trying to get the distribution rights to the BBC and steal away from Channel 21, who actually used to distribute it and make money from it. And they now actually distribute it and make money from it. But since the news guy wanted to be news, who spent $8 million to create a news show and didn't, he created the show and then tried to get the funding, whereas the previous president would get the funding and then he would make the show. So that kind of says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. Had you kept continuously distributing BBC, would you still be its distributor and collecting some money on that?
Well, let's put it this way. If W1BKL was still running the place, we'd probably still be making a good chunk of money from the BBC. And we wouldn't have had a news show that lasted 8 months and cost a lot of money.
I think you pronounced it BKL. Isn't it BKR, his call letters?
BKR, as in Robert.
Yep. I'll have to play back the tape. It sounded like BKL, but maybe it's my accent. Oh, well. Name a science, space, astronomy, PBS show in the pipeline that I can look forward to.
Nova. Nature. Great performances. Which is not in that genre, but... actually, PBS is an organization that is in deep trouble. You know, the government keeps taking more funding away rather than prompting it up. But, what's his life?
Okay. Do you happen to know of some Nova subjects? Nova or nature subjects, but Nova in particular, that are in the pipeline that I can look forward to?
Actually, give me a second and I'll tell you. I just have to get into my little log of the work for a second because I know what the list is. I think we're at the end of the season, not the beginning of the season, but let me see. W-K-2J, but take another second.
And on subjects also include Frontline. Right now, Nova, Frontline, and Nature, in that order, are my favorites.
About the Antique Roadshow.
Not as much. You collect antique radios. My radios are antique, but I didn't get them because I collect them.
Just particularly, I like to look at what people, you know, come up with and all, and find you see a real gem and say, geez, I think I got that too.
Well, let's see. We've got Inca skull surgery. We've got Amazing Ants. We've got The Storm That Drowned the City, which is about a hurricane. I think this one aired. We have The Hunt for the Super Twister. And then another one about Mount St. Helens, Back from the Dead. I think that aired already. So I think the season is coming to a close at the moment.
Yeah, the very first one, I missed what you said. So the first one you mentioned, say it again slowly.
Inca Skull Surgery, the INCA, you know, the people who died out, they have evidence of a radical surgical procedure common amongst the Incas over 500 years ago.
And that may have aired. Is that the one where the skulls have got a number of significant holes in them of a very characteristic nature?
I think that's it.
Can you imagine an operation like that without anesthesia? My goodness, there must have been a lot of screaming and hollering.
Okay, let's see. These have all aired. The ones that have aired, Killer Subs at Pearl Harbor, Building Fairy Ships, Riddles of the Sphinx, The Ghost of the Machu Picchu, Extreme Cave Diving, The Pluto Files, Hunting to the Edge of Space, Mind Over Money, and Mount St. Helens. I have to actually dig a little more to see what's in production.
I believe a certain percentage of those have already aired.
No, those have all aired.
I kind of thought so.
Those have all aired. That goes back. I got to dig a little deeper to find out what's in production.
I'm going to have to go away from the mic a little while. Somebody's hollering at me.
All right, Dick. Till the next time. K2RIW, K2J.
Dick, are you going to be on the air soon?
K2YO.
Hello, Bunny.
Yeah, is it Wesley? I was wondering whether he's going to show up or he's going to sleep.
Are you Wesley?
Yeah, that's me. I was wondering whether Dick is going to bed or he's going to be back on the radio.
I think Dick is gone for the night.
I'm actually a few miles from his house. I just have to drop something for him and go. of whether I would be able to ask if I could drop it. He doesn't even have to give me the time, just have something. Because I'm coming back.